here on State versus Morris Seaton, 21 AP 1399 CR. The court is here. Justice Protasiewicz is not participating in this case this morning, so you're here with the remainder of us. Could I have your appearances, please? Good morning. All right. The lineup is 25 minutes, 30 minutes back for rebuttal, 5 minutes, right? Okay. Please proceed. Let me just clarify first before we start your time. Waupun High School here? All right, if you'd stand up, please, we'd like to say hello to you. Great, nice to see you this morning. You're here with court, with class. Justice Rebecca Bradley would be meeting with you afterwards if you have enough time this morning. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Go ahead and have a seat. All right, now let's start.
Good morning, and may it please the court. In sexual assault cases, the law favors the admission of similar other acts committed by the defendant. The Sullivan test is not a significant hurdle for the proponent. To the extent that Sullivan is a barrier, the greater latitude rule further eases admission of this evidence in these cases. This is true whether the case involves minor or adult victims. It is true whether non-consent is an element of the crime, and it is true regardless of the defense theory. And this is so because of the difficult issues of proof in these credibility contests. In this case, involving allegations that Seaton had non-consensual intercourse with Anna, a 17-year-old friend whom he isolated after she had been drinking, the circuit court incorrectly applied Sullivan and greater latitude and reached an unreasonable result when it excluded evidence of strikingly similar allegations that about a year earlier, Seaton had non-consensual intercourse with Jane, another 17-year-old acquaintance whom he isolated after she had been drinking. This court should reverse that decision. We're also asking this court to overrule its decision in Alstein and the Court of Appeals decision in Cofield, and we're asking this court to reiterate that bolstering or undercutting a witness's credibility is a permissible purpose under the first step of Sullivan.
I want to talk a little bit about just the standard of review. Obviously, we're deferential in these situations. What precise wrong standard of law do you think was applied in this situation?
I think the circuit court started off on the wrong foot by framing the admission of other acts as an exception rather than a rule.
So, when I read that in your brief, I mean, I'm not sure that the court used that as a, you know, rubric for making its final decision. It talked about some basic boilerplate understanding of the law. I'm not sure that its framing is totally unwarranted based upon prior cases. That seems like a big claim that because you sort of recite that kind of formulation, and even if one could argue about exactly how these things ought to be framed, and maybe cases have talked about it a little differently, that's enough to say you've applied the wrong standard of law, reverse.
Well, and that's not the only thing. I think there was a problem, too, in how the court addressed the permissible purposes. It talked kind of about the permissible purposes, but kept jumping forward to the second part of the second step to the probative value and relevance. And the decision was a little bit confusing to follow because by the end, the court said the state hasn't given us any permissible purposes, when really the key to the question is going to come in on the second part of the relevance question of whether the probative value is, there's enough probative value, enough similarity between the two acts. And here, I think if you read this decision next to something like Dorsey, it's really hard to square how the court could reasonably exclude this evidence of strikingly similar acts When in Dorsey, we've talked about, you know, how greater latitude applies, how greater latitude, you know, basically really eases the admission of this evidence. So, and taking into consideration the standard of review, I understand it is a deferential, it's a question of an erroneous exercise of discretion. But when we look at cases dealing with evidentiary decisions and it implicates, for example, a constitutional violation, we look at whether, you know, the kind of discretion used is looked at as a question of law. In this case, we have statutes saying, the greater latitude statute saying, and case law saying that this evidence really easily comes in, and it's going to be kind of an exception that it would be excluded. So under that sort of framework, it is an exercise of discretion, but it is going to be pretty difficult to uphold an exclusion of evidence when it is so similar.
So, I mean, assume for the moment that I don't see a particular error of wrong standard of law that was applied for a minute. We're just in the discretionary area. I understand. It seems to me that you could argue that the wrong standard was applied, and we can get back to that for a minute. But that your burden would be here to show that there was no reasonable judge could look at these set of facts and conclude that they were not sufficiently similar. I mean, as I read the trial court's decision, and maybe read it differently, and maybe that's, you know, maybe this case comes down to how you look at the record here, but the trial court did situate that within the first prong of Sullivan and indicate there was no permissible purpose because we don't have acts that are sufficiently similar and it doesn't fit any of the purposes. Credibility is not standalone. I know we can get to that in a minute. So it looks at the facts and just reasons through it differently. And, you know, judges could have come the other way on that. No question about it. Many judges probably would have, and many judges might have agreed with that. It just seems like a pretty tall ask to say no reasonable judge could look at these two sets of facts and say, they have to be the same. They're similar enough. You have to let this in.
Well, I think if we were only dealing with, if we were only saying, well, greater latitude applies and it's, you know, still an open, you know, open area of law of what kind of evidence comes in or doesn't or how it applies, I think there might be a question of that. But I think when you look at some, like a case like Dorsey, when you look at our whole body of case law, applying these cases and, you know, basically upholding this evidence in every other situation, I think it becomes harder to defend it as a reasonable decision.
But under a standard review, you could have the exact same set of facts.
Mm-hmm.
And we could, in most of our cases seem to arise in the context of evidence being admitted, potentially, and then challenged.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's a very different scenario than when evidence is not admitted
right.
and challenged. So you could have the exact same set of facts and know that reasonable judges could look at it differently in this court or the Court of Appeals affirm simply because we're applying the proper standard of review and knowing that reasonable judges could look at these set of facts and come to different conclusions.
And that could be your view of the facts, Your Honor, and I don't know that I can change your mind necessarily on that. I will say, though, the state has appealed these decisions pretty regularly and pretty regularly gotten reversals, even under that very deferential standard of review. I attached two cases, Smogoleski, Carias, Granados, to brief to illustrate. But I think given how strongly the legislative policy is behind greater latitude and how this court has understood it, I think there is a very narrow window for this type of evidence to be excluded. And I don't think under the facts of this case that it would have done so.
If we were just going to apply the standard of review, why in the world would we take this case? We accepted it for certification, but if the end of the analysis is great deference to the trial court, we're not answering any of the questions that were presented in the certification. We should just say improvidently grant, it seems.
That's yes. I don't know why you would take it just to to affirm under the standard of review, and we would probably, and the state would probably be more reluctant to appeal it if it was truly that strict in this case.
As I read the certification, and I understand your argument, you think that Alstein and Cofield should be kaput. Pick another word.
Put to
overruled.
Rest.
How about that? Should be overruled. And of course, the poor Court of Appeals says, but hey, you know, Alstein is a Supreme Court case. We can't overrule it. And so on occasion, of course, when the Court of Appeals apparently disagrees with a premise of law and is tied by their jurisdictional limits, they can't overrule a Supreme Court decision, they kick it up to us. Indeed, you are asking that those two cases be overruled, essentially.
Yes.
Am I correct or incorrect?
You are correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Right, but we have to get to the issue to decide that, right? I mean, if we're just saying deference to the trial court decision, you don't get to the issue that you've asked us to take.
Well, I asked you to take the issue of reversing the circuit court. I assume that you took the certification to address Alstein, which would be extremely helpful to the lower courts, because obviously there is confusion. The fact that the question was certified reflects that there is, confusion and some disconnect.
I'm clear on what you want. I'm just saying if we write this case and if it turns out to be the trial court exercised its discretion, therefore we affirm, we don't get to the issues that you've suggested we should get to unless we're just going to write on things that aren't relevant to that standard.
I would say if the circuit court didn't rely on Alstein and Cofield, so I suppose that would be true. I think the question of whether credibility is a permissible purpose is still part of the circuit court's decision, and so
I want you to talk about that, please, because
sure.
I read the cases, and while credibility is talked about in Marinez and Hunt, and to some extent in Dorsey just a little bit, all of those cases are cases where credibility is particularly an issue. Like Hunt and Marinez were recantation cases.
Right.
So what I hear you arguing, though, is that credibility, we all know it's always an issue. If you're saying it's a permissible standalone purpose, I'm not quite sure why we even go through any of this, because you could just say credibility is always an issue, it always comes in. And I feel like that's what you're arguing. So tell me whether that is what you're arguing and why I should accept that.
That's not exactly what I'm arguing.
Okay.
So when we talk about credibility as a permissible purpose, and you're correct, the court's looked at it in several ways, as grouped with context and to explain the state of mind and give a complete story. So to explain what a victim did during a course of conduct. And we see that in Marinez and Schaller. Other situation is to rehabilitate a victim who's recanted, and that's Hunt and CDC. Dorsey talks about it in the context of corroborating a victim's story based on strikingly similar other acts involving a different victim.
Okay, but that is, if you're going to say it's credibility, obviously credibility plays in and you can't separate it out, but isn't in a sexual assault case, isn't it always being used to bolster the victim's account of what happened? Wouldn't that swallow the rule? If you just said credibility is the purpose, that's it. We don't look at, that's the permissible purpose. You don't even need to look at anything else.
Well, you still need to look at whether the acts are relevant to that and whether they're strikingly, whether they satisfy the they're strikingly similar enough to be probative. Thank you.
It might matter in which kind of case we're talking about, too.
It
might matter in the kind of case that you're talking about. You could have a sexual assault case where you're trying to figure out whether or not the conviction should be a first-degree sexual assault or a third-degree sexual assault, right?
And that's
right. And credibility may or may not be an issue because you might have other physical evidence.
Correct.
But it comes into play more in sexual assault cases where you don't have any other physical evidence.
That's right.
Which brings me to a point that I want to make here, and that is to thank you for footnote number 2 in your brief, where you talk about no longer using, I don't even want to say it in this courtroom, but I'm going to, the he said, she said descriptor. I appreciate you noting that it is almost, I've never seen it used in a case other than when a female is a victim in a sexual assault case or a domestic violence case. I challenge anyone in this room or anyone who is watching and listening to show me a case where it is used, where there's a he said, he said situation. So thank you. I've been on a multi-year mission to get this out of our vocabulary in these types of cases, and so far I've been on the losing end, so I appreciate that. For a question, go back to what you first started out talking about here, which is the error of law. Can you walk me through your analysis on the error of law that the circuit court judge made in this case?
So I think, as I noted, the court started off on the wrong foot by describing it as a rule of exclusion and looking for essentially holding the state to a higher burden of requiring it to show a permissible purpose and relevance. The state identified, I think motive, modus operandi, plan, intent, identity, opportunity, and said the similarity of these acts is showing a pattern of behavior where the defendant finds a younger acquaintance. She's been drinking. They're drinking together. He isolates her, presses her for sex. She resists. He continues without obtaining consent and leaves. And so all of that goes to the idea of mode of operation, identity, plan, intent. We talked about this in Zeebart and in Hunt, in other cases. The other main argument the state had was that it was proof of motive and intent, which is lines up with how this court decided the issue in Dorsey. Just one moment to go back to Justice Dowlett's question about if credibility is a permissible purpose, won't that be everything? Really, in nearly every sexual assault case, motive and intent are issues as well. That's a means to get in this evidence a lot of the time. Motive, intent, purpose, we've talked about in Hunt and in Hurley and Dorsey and Marinez, that these are part of all of these cases. So introducing credibility isn't going to open a door any wider than motive, intent, and purpose do already. In terms of what the circuit court's decision, I think the problem is that it ruled that the state failed to identify a permissible purpose, but it gave short shrift to all the purposes that the state tried to introduce. It just simply said, is this motive? I don't think so. Is this intent? I don't think you argued it. Is this opportunity? No. When I think the state was trying to introduce this, I think it really gave short shrift to the relevance argument and to the permissible purposes when that first step is really just setting forth the stage for the rest of the analysis.
When that first step is what?
The first step is really just identifying the framework that you're going to look at the rest of the steps under Sullivan. So, and another point on the credibility question, even if you identify credibility as a permissible purpose, you still have to draw it under the second step. It still has to be relevant to that purpose. So what the first step is doing is saying, okay, motive is the permissible purpose that we want to enter this under credibility. Under the second step of relevance, you say, okay, how is that relevant to credibility? How is that relevant to motive under the circumstances? And the court here, I don't think, allowed the state or considered the state's argument under those burdens.
Counsel, can I ask a little bit about the Alstein issue?
Mm-hmm.
I find that to be confusing, and honestly, I found the Court of Appeals certification a little confusing, and the Court of Appeals reading, it seemed to have been bound by something. And when I looked at the cases, I guess I just don't really see any conflict. And I wonder if you might be able to help me here. Because Alstein says that you simply, that evidence of prior acts has no probative value on the issue of that particular victim's consent, right? But then we have, you know, Zibart, which comes later and says, but yeah, you can let it in if there is a different permissible purpose. So, and none of them talked about greater latitude. And so Alstein seemed to be focused purely on the issue of relevance. It doesn't address other possible permissible purposes. We don't have an issue of relevance here, at least under the circuit court's reasoning, which was just based upon that first step, again, as I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a consent, you know, the same kind of consent question, you know, here. And so I don't really understand why any of that is before us or why we need to address it, why it's a stumbling block to a decision on this case. I'm not sure what we need to clarify in order to address this. And I don't see any evidence through the years that these kinds of things have been stumbling blocks in other cases. I haven't seen it before.
Sure. These cases have come up in unpublished decisions here and there, although I would say not maybe in the last 15, 20 years. But I will say that I think Zibart was incredibly kind, perhaps, or to the language in Alstein, because though Alstein says it doesn't eliminate other permissible purposes, there's a paragraph in there where it talks about, it says, well, we're not even going to consider other permissible purposes because the evidence is irrelevant, which doesn't make sense under how we do the Sullivan rule, how we apply the Sullivan test. You have to get to the permissible purpose to talk about relevance. I think the other damage that Alstein does is by saying, calling consent the only issue in a case, I think, is simply wrong, first of all. I think it puts the focus on the victim. It's sort of putting the victim on trial in terms of her consent when the question of consent goes to so much more, including the defendant's credibility, including the evidence, corroborating evidence, other witnesses, what happened before and what happened after. And it's not just a matter of victim consent.
Don't our cases more or less make that clear, though? I understand what you're saying, but this Alstein was decided in 1982, and if the way it framed a case is maybe a little different or maybe narrowed the issues in a way that our recent cases clearly don't, do we really need to go back and do a bunch of clarification on cases from 40 years ago?
You might not. I mean, when I argued this to the Court of Appeals, I thought the Court of Appeals could get around Alstein, and I actually didn't, you know, ask them to consider overruling it or identify any problem with it. I thought Zibart clarified it enough. I think in considering the issue after certification and reading through how the Court of Appeals looked at it, I think that certification alone reflected some confusion. It's really just unnecessarily confusing, and it's not adding anything to the law. This isn't a must you overrule it? Maybe not, but I think it stands to confuse courts going forward and adds a necessary questions, especially given that, you know, Zibart's clarifying it, but that's a Court of Appeals case, and Court of Appeals, to the extent it's changing Alstein, it can't do that. So I think some clarification is warranted to assist the courts.
One other just quick question on the credibility issue. If we did agree with you, what would you want us to say about that as a standalone purpose? How are you asking us to frame that as a separate, standalone, permissible purpose?
I think it would just be framed, bolstering or undercutting credibility is a standalone permissible purpose under the Sullivan test. And I mean, and I think you could limit it to cases in which greater latitude applies, because I think the greater latitude rule is what is making it a permissible purpose. So the purpose of greater latitude is to ease the admission of evidence that assists the jury in determining credibility. That is its purpose. That would seemingly make that a permissible purpose in these cases.
Is there ever a situation where you wouldn't be using an other act to bolster credibility of a victim? Name me one situation ever in the entire universe.
Well, I think an example would be in the Alstein case, there were two other acts that the state sought to admit. So the original crime was an older teen was claimed to be sexually assaulted in a car after the defendant was claiming to give her a ride home, and he stopped the car and assaulted her. The state sought to admit two other crimes. One was the defendant was found lying on top of a naked 11-year-old with possibly his pants undone, with no other real explanation. The other one was another situation where he was giving a woman a ride home and sexually assaulted her in his car. I would say the evidence of the state might argue that the evidence of him lying on top of the 11-year-old it goes to credibility, but I think it would be reasonable for the court to say not relevant to credibility, not similar enough to be probative, and even, you know, too prejudicial to be, you know, too prejudicial.
So it doesn't really stand alone, even in what you're arguing.
Well, it's a permissible purpose. The state can argue, the state will argue this permissible purpose, but it still has to link it, based on relevance and probative value. And I see I'm over my time, so I'll finish up on the bottom.
You may finish your sentence.
I think, you know, the hang-up about having it as a first step, I understand it, but it's still, the meat of the Sullivan analysis is really step two, and the state still has to meet its burden under step two.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Melinda Swartz, and I represent the defendant, respondent, Moore Seaton, and I'm asking this court to affirm the circuit court's denial of the state's motion to admit other acts evidence. The state is really asking this court to do two things, and there's two points that I want to make, and I believe Justice Hagedorn addressed some of this in his question, but the state is essentially asking this court to change the well-settled standard of review of the discretionary decision for evidentiary decisions to require a circuit court to speculate about, think of, and rule on all arguments that the parties could have made but didn't think of at the time. And the second thing is the state is asking for a rule of law that would essentially permit other acts evidence in nearly all sexual assault cases, in essence swallowing the rule of exclusion for propensity evidence. I just want to address a couple things.
This isn't being used as propensity evidence under the subsection of the statute. Right?
But if this court rules that credibility is a standalone permissible purpose, then it would be using propensity evidence, because that's really what this is. It really is propensity evidence. No matter how the state tries to frame it, it's propensity evidence.
Is your argument that everything that would come in under 904.04 sub 2 sub b sub 1 is propensity evidence?
Unless it goes to a specific purpose, a permissible purpose but this court has never ruled that credibility evidence credibility is its own permissible purpose. So if it were a different kind of case, if it were child sexual assault where sexual contact, the intent for sexual contact or the motive or the purpose for sexual contact, then it would come in. So maybe I should clarify, I mean, that it could come in if it's relevant to that. But it can't come in as a standalone on its just credibility as a permissible purpose. And there's a couple of things I want to address. To where the state is criticizing the circuit court for requiring the state to meet a burden of proof on for permissible purpose and relevancy, that is the state's hurdle. The state has to meet those two. They do have the burden of proof on those things. And to the extent that the state is saying that it came in Dorsey and for if it came in Dorsey as far as credibility is concerned, Dorsey allowed the it came in for the permissible purposes of intent and motive, but the court addressed witness credibility as far as relevancy is concerned. And to the extent that the state argues that it won't come in other cases other than sexual assault, it will come in other cases other than sexual assault cases and other cases that won't involve greater latitude because permissible purposes are not charge specific. Under the Sullivan analysis, permissible purposes are not limited to the charge. So it could come in a theft case. It could come in a battery case. It could come in all sorts of other cases, not just sexual assault cases. So I do want to just briefly address the standard of review. I think the state's position, the standard of review is whether the circuit court applied the proper law to the relevant facts and reached a reasonable conclusion. And unless it can be said that no reasonable judge acting under the same facts and the same law could reach the same conclusion, the circuit court's decision should be upheld. The question is not whether this court would have admitted the evidence or the Court of Appeals would have admitted the evidence. The question is really broken down to two things. Did the court understand the law? Did the circuit court understand the law? And I think it's pretty clear that it did. The state's position in its brief, and it uses the word incorrectly applied more than once, and that's not the correct standard of review. The question is, did the judge apply it reasonably? Here it did, based on the arguments and based on what the party said before it. Changing of the standard of review would require a party to hold, would be an incentive for a party to hold back arguments and then raise them later in an appellate court, basically sandbagging the lower court to make a new argument on appeal. And I think here the circuit court properly exercised its discretion, and it reached a reasonable conclusion to exclude this evidence. And if you look at the arguments that were actually made by the state in the circuit court, the circuit court's decision was reasonable on the arguments the state presented at the time of the circuit court proceedings. The reason is that the proponent of the admission of evidence must clearly articulate a reason for the admission of that evidence and apply the case facts to that analytical framework. And I'm citing Sullivan 216 Wiz Second at 774 for that. And really, the permissible purpose is meant to develop the framework for the relevancy determination. And this court said that both in Hurley at paragraph 62 and at Marina's at paragraph 25. Here, what was before the circuit court was, and the state's written and oral arguments, it identified identity, plan, and modus operandi. Those are the arguments that the state made in supporting the admission of this evidence, and it also said bolstering the victim's credibility. As it's clear, identity is not an issue here. Plan is not an issue here, and modus operandi is not an issue here. It's not distinctive enough to prove identity or plan.
What about opportunity?
I think the state's abandon. The state might have abandoned that argument in its footnote in its reply brief. That opportunity, I believe it did on page 7, footnote 1. It said that it argued opportunity below in its opening brief, but its argument in support of that purpose is more goes to mode of operation and plan. So it abandoned that. So turning back to bolstering an adult victim's credibility, this court has never said that it's a standalone permissible purpose. This court has never held that, and this court should not do that now. The state admits that other acts evidence will be admissible if the court finds that bolstering a victim's credibility is a standalone permissible purpose. The state admits that other acts evidence.
Let me ask you a question looking at paragraph 50 of Dorsey.
Which?
Paragraph 50 of Dorsey. This court wrote that Dorsey, of course, was a case involving two different victims of domestic violence. We say that we've held that credibility is particularly probative in cases that come down to, I'm going to use my language here, credibility contests. Moreover, the difficult proof issues in these kinds of cases, quote, provide the rationale behind the greater latitude. It follows that the greater latitude rule allows for the more liberal admission of other acts evidence that has a tendency to assist the jury in assessing credibility. And then there's a cite to Marinez. So I'm just unclear, given your arguments on credibility today, how we are to read paragraph 50 in Dorsey and paragraph 34 in Marinez, which similarly talks about credibility, because, of course, the whole reason we have the greater latitude rule, this comes from child sexual assault cases, right, where jurors are being asked to assess credibility of children discussing sexual assault. And it was and continues, in my opinion, to be very, very difficult for jurors to wrap their heads around that. And so the greater latitude came into existence in this case. Judges have been applying the greater latitude rule in child sexual assault cases for decades. The legislature realized when they changed 90404 in 2014, I think it was, that the same rationale should be applied to domestic violence cases and to sexual assault cases. That is that in those cases, jurors were having a hard time understanding victims' testimony. They didn't believe victims. And so the legislature stepped in and they modified the law. They did the same thing in the federal rules of evidence, right? And in fact, they took it one step further. So now we have case law interpreting that change, and I am reading that change to be consistent with the reasons that this law was changed in the first place, and that is that historically we just don't believe victims, especially when they're women and children. And so we've got this language in Dorsey, and we've got this language in Marinez that says, you know what, we're recognizing that. We're all starting to understand this now. And I'm sorry, Marinez was before the change in the statute. But Dorsey was after. We're seeing that now. We understand that now. And we see that credibility is an issue in these cases. But now you're telling me that we shouldn't worry about credibility in these cases. And I cannot even begin to wrap my head around that.
Okay, so first starting with Marinez, okay, I'm first going to start with Marinez. Okay, in Marinez, there was a specific purpose, and in Dorsey, there was a specific purpose for the admission of that evidence. Okay, in Marinez, it was a 4-year-old child victim who was not going to be testifying. It was a videotaped, their testimony was presented by videotape. So the purpose was to identify...
Well, the victim would have to be available for cross-examination, yes?
That's true. Okay. But in any event, the purpose was for identification of the defendant. And that's why the other acts evidence came in, because she identified him as the person who had burnt her hands previously. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's why it came in Marina's and in child sexual assault case. And in Dorsey... It came in, the permissible purposes were intent and motive. The intent, the intent that the person had, the defendant had, to hurt the victim, and the motive that the person had, and it went to their intent to cause bodily harm and their motive to control the victim, mm-hmm, within the context of a domestic relationship. So that is why the evidence came in that case. It did not solely go to, it did not solely have for a permissible purpose the victim's credibility.
What is the intent in the sexual assault case?
In this case, there is no statutory intent that the state needs to prove. There is no statutory intent. So the defendant, Mr. Seaton's intent...
There's no prosecutor in the world that's going to stand up in front of a jury and say, oh, you know what happened here? This defendant, you know, suddenly, accidentally sexually assaulted this woman. He had to have intended to do it. He had to have meant to do it, whether or not that is the mens rea that the state has to prove. I think it is, you can't think of a situation where someone could engage in an act of sexual intercourse without meaning to do so. You don't recklessly have intercourse with someone.
But that's different than sexually assaulting someone. You, having intercourse, there's, having intercourse is with a person is different than having intercourse with a person without their consent.
Well, I understand that.
Okay.
My point is that you're trying to say that intent could not be an issue here, that MO couldn't be a motive here. I mean, look at the similarities in these cases. This is what I have a really hard time with, that in the two situations, in the fact scenario, in the case that's before us, and in the proffered evidence, we've got two 17-year-old girls. They are both under the influence of alcohol. Your client knows it. Your client isolates them. In my mind, that's opportunity. I don't know. I must be the only one in this room who sees it as opportunity. To me, that's just super, super clear. Let's see. They're 17. They are both acquaintances of your client from high school. He's a peer of theirs. They both had consumed alcohol. He knew they'd consumed alcohol. He removed the clothes of both of them. He forces intercourse on both of them. And he continues, according to the facts alleged in both of the cases, to sexually assault them when both the victims say no.
I disagree with the court. I respectfully disagree with the court. These are not similar situations. I think, as the circuit court found, they have a different relationship. He was a close friend with Anna. Can I use the words? Can I say Anna and Jane?
I think those are pseudonyms, yes.
Okay, but I can say those and everyone knows. So Anna was his close friend, all right, and he was invited to her home. He did not isolate her. She took herself into her bedroom, and the situation that happened in Whitewater, allegedly, with Jane, is a situation where Jane is claiming and is alleging that he snatched her from, like, basically snatched her and secreted her away, like, and he took an opportunity and put her behind somewhere where she wouldn't be seen by people. And the level of force that is used, I think the circuit court mentioned this too, the level of force that was used was different, and also how he came into contact with both of them that day. And is that he was invited. He's a friend of Anna's, and he came to her house like he had been there 15. I think the record shows he'd been there 15 times before. She had been to his house 5 times. And Jane is really an acquaintance at best. And their ages are not really an issue, as the court said, because he's 19, and they're really peers. I mean, these are schoolmates. So it is different in that way. And I just think that you have to look at the type of relationship. It is not the same. And for those purposes...
Why would the type of relationship make any difference in a sexual assault case?
It makes a difference in this case.
Why?
Okay? It makes a difference in this case because they are dissimilar. And I think that is the problem with... Because really, what that argument is that it's propensity. That's a propensity argument, that he is, has, you know, really, and that's what's prejudicial, is that he has a propensity, what the, I believe what the court is, and we can disagree, is really that he has a propensity to have sexual intercourse with people without their consent. And that's a propensity. That is a propensity argument, and that is what the case law and the statute prohibits. Because really, if this, if the legislature had wanted to not require...
Are you saying that any time other acts evidence comes in as propensity evidence?
I'm not saying that. I'm talking about this case. I'm talking about this case. And if the legislature had wanted to make it create, make it easier to admit other acts evidence, it could have drafted a statute like the federal statute that allowed, it says that the court may admit other acts without having the, having to, what we, what our state, what our legislature requires, which is a statute that requires the state to prove a permissible purpose and prove that it's relevant.
Counsel, just to clarify, we don't have to agree that they're not similarly, or that they are not similarly situated or similar enough acts. We just have to agree under your argument that a reasonable judge could so conclude under the standard of review, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. There's another point I want to make that, in a sense, if this court accepts the state's argument that this evidence should come in to bolster a victim's credibility, the other side of the coin is to impeach the defendant's credibility on that. So really, you'd be opening the door, and then what should come in to bolster the defendant's credibility are, or a defendant's credibility, are perhaps prior sexual partners of the defendant to show that he did, if someone asked them to stop, he did stop, or former girlfriends showing that there were acts that were consensual. So I think that that's something else that should be considered, is that it's really opening the door to other acts that go to the defendant, that bolster the defendant's credibility too. And turning to Alstein, a couple points I want to make about Alstein, and I think perhaps the court, Justice Hagedorn is correct, that there is no requirement to overrule Alstein, because Alstein really dealt with relevancy, and it had to do with whether one person's consent is or non-consent is really relevant to another person's non-consent. And the reason why it only dealt with relevancy is because it's a pre-Sullivan case. So it never got to a proper purpose. So if Alstein is just put in its relevancy, which it is, then there's no need to overrule Alstein, and there's no need to overrule Cofield either. And I think the premise on Alstein is correct, that one complainant's alleged non-consensual sexual intercourse does not tend to prove that another complainant in an unrelated event did not consent to sexual intercourse with the same person. And the greater latitude rule does not change Alstein's ruling. I also want to say that I think this court, I'm relying as far as the other issues are concerned, I think that this court should affirm for these reasons, and that the evidence is not relevant here, and that the state cannot meet its burden of proof that this evidence is relevant here. Jane's claim of non-consent is not related to whether Anna consented months later at her own bed, and it doesn't make it more or less probable that Anna did not consent. Assuming arguendo that this court finds that the circuit court erred in not finding a purpose and that this court finds it's relevant, this court should affirm because any arguable probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. There's a tendency, the case law is very clear, to influence that what the danger of unfair prejudice is a tendency to influence the outcome by improper means. And here the issue is that Jane's allegations are disputed, unsubstantiated, and uncharged, and introducing them would require Mr. Seaton to defend against both, and it would distract the jury from the real issue that's before it, which is whether Anna consented or not. Jane's allegations are more serious, and they appeal to the jury's sympathy and horror. And unless there's any other questions, I'm going to take a seat.
All right, thank you. Well,
thank you. Just addressing a few points. Other acts evidence is propensity evidence. The Sullivan test doesn't remove propensity. It identifies an additional purpose to propensity. So to the extent that counsel's saying this is all propensity evidence, that's always there. It's that what Sullivan is doing is creating a framework and essentially assisting the court in coming up with instructions and limiting the jury in how it can consider this evidence, so it doesn't go to the propensity purpose. But the test doesn't remove all propensity. I just want to make that clear. Just addressing kind of the questions during the initial argument about where was the error of law here, in addition to the points I made, the points that the court determined were too different were not linked to the purpose or relevance of them. So the difference between one assault occurring outside or inside, a different nature, a different intensity of the relationship to begin with, none of those had to do with what the state's purposes were in offering it, which is to show that this is a pattern of behavior that Seaton engaged in, where he engages with an acquaintance or a friend. He knows they've been drinking. He either isolates them or finds them in an isolated situation, and he presses sex whenever they're not really in a position to consent and with no evidence of consent. The other point I wanted to make is just in relation to Justice Hagedorn's question near the beginning. At 4627 in the court's decision, I do think the court really is leaning on the belief that this is an exceptional situation to admit this evidence. She said, as I stated at the outset, this is the exception, not the rule. And there's language in other parts of the decision where where the court goes back to that sort of belief.
Let me just explain for just a brief minute, because historically this evidence was not allowed.
Right.
And then over time, this has begun to be more and more allowed, right? The exceptions kind of was at one point restricted to just the same victim. Then it gets expanded beyond that. Then you have these statutory amendments. If you want this evidence to come in, you still have to file a motion about it, right? And get the preclearance, which is not necessarily true with other kinds of evidence. So it almost feels like your argument is the law as it stands now says trial courts, you need to admit it most of the time, and maybe it's error if you don't. But I feel like, and maybe maybe feel free to make this point back, but there are at least some trial court judges are decent. And I remember one who told me at one point that I rarely allow this evidence in because I think it's too prejudicial and generally not probative enough. And I get that's a different part of the analysis in some respects. But, trial courts think about this differently. It doesn't seem wrong to me to think about this as a statute that permits it but does not require it. It feels like you're getting closer to saying it almost requires it, and it's the exception when it's excluded.
I think it's going to be a rare occasion when this evidence doesn't come in under the statute, and I think that's just what the legislature has said. That's the legislative policy enacted in the statute. I think in terms of, the statute is kind of creating a framework for the jury to consider this evidence that isn't propensity. Now, this is different than under federal law. Like, the evidence here, if we were in federal court, it would come in for propensity. We don't even need to do the analysis. So, you know, by admitting it, by saying it's for these particular purposes, and I think very importantly, we're missing out that the jury's instructed at the end to say, you heard evidence of X happening. You may only consider it for this purpose that the court has already decided. You may not use it to decide that the defendant's a bad person or, as propensity. So, we have these safeguards in place to really limit how, prejudicial it is, at the same rate allowing juries to have the full spectrum of evidence that they should have whenever they're determining credibility in these cases. I want to note that the state did argue all of the things that I had noted it argued in its motion at 21, 3, and 6, motive, identity, plan, opportunity, modus operandi, bolstering credibility. At the hearing at 46:15, it repeated those things. In terms of opportunity, may I finish the thought? My point in the reply brief was that my argument under opportunity is essentially the same as plan, in that he is creating the situation where he can get these individuals whom he knows alone and in a position to have sex with them. So opportunity, in my view, in this case, is still part of it. We're asking this court to reverse the circuit court and overrule Alstein. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for an interesting argument. The court is adjourned. We will reconvene.